morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'd like to reserve, I believe, 6 minutes for rebuttal, please.
6 minutes, okay.
Thank you. My name is Lincoln Beauregard. I represent Murgatou Argo, the plaintiff in this case. There's really only one substantive issue before this court in this particular appeal. It's whether Ms. Argo has a right to sue an entity known as Port Jobs for employment discrimination. This is an unconventional case in that Ms. Argo was, in form, an employee of an entity known as Neighborhood House. That's who sent her her paychecks. That's who wrote her performance reviews. Substantively, Ms. Argo also worked for Port Jobs. That's where she went to work every day. She answered to a supervisor at that entity as well. There's documents in the file that show that when Ms. Argo interviewed for the job, Neighborhood House and Port Jobs acknowledged that she would be working for both entities simultaneously. You'll notice this, there's no spirited fight on the merits of the actual employment claim in the briefing before the court. Port Jobs hasn't pushed back or fought hard to say that Ms. Argo wouldn't have a claim if she had standing to bring it. So as I started out by saying, the issue before the court is Ms. Argo's standing to file this lawsuit. We've contended in our briefing that the proper analysis for this particular claim would be to look at the contract between Neighborhood House and Port Jobs and then ask the question, because clearly Ms. Argo isn't an actual party to that contract, ask the question whether or not she's a quote-unquote third-party beneficiary to that particular contract. It's kind of unprecedented in Washington to have this issue. It is unprecedented in Washington to have this issue, and that's why procedurally we had kind of a mess coming up here as far as getting to the right issue, but that's the issue. And if this court were to look at the federal court law, which is pretty much unanimous on this particular topic, there's only one conclusion you can reach, is that Ms. Argo was a third-party beneficiary.
She has to be an intended beneficiary, not just a beneficiary, incidental beneficiary. Why is she an intended beneficiary?
I agree with that, Your Honor. She has to be an intended beneficiary as to the substance of the contract. So I think what the court's asking is basically this contract says, well, we don't mean for her to be an employee of Port Jobs or whatever else expressly in the document. However, if you look to the Lonsdale opinion and the other case law that's been cited, the question isn't that a potential employer writes into a contract, well, unless we're going to get sued for discrimination, then they're not an employee. The question would be substantively, did Ms. Argo benefit from that contract? That's my reading of the case law. Put another way, the contract itself that's at issue here was between Port Jobs and Neighborhood House to say, we're going to fill a position. Ms. Argo ultimately filled that particular position. She was the benefactor of that contract. So I know what the issue, and probably the stickiest issue for this court would be just what Judge Cox just asked about, would be, again, can Port Jobs just write into a contract and say, well, she's not our employee, and that mean that she's not a benefactor to the contract? She is.
Well, so, isn't that an indication, though, that there was an intent? If you're writing into a contract, words to the effect of, we don't intend to benefit anybody other than the parties to this contract. I don't intend to have a relationship with anybody other than the parties to this contract. Isn't that an indication that you don't have any intent to benefit anybody but the parties to the contract?
Judge Wire, I'd submit in the context of a discrimination tort, that would be one component of evidence that Port Jobs is going to cite too strongly before a jury.
Well, that goes to, but in terms of whether it's a, whether the person is a third-party beneficiary or an incidental beneficiary. Because we're looking at the contracting party's intent, not the third party's intent.
I understand the question, and yeah. My quick answer would be, I believe a third-party beneficiary would be who substantively benefits, not by necessarily the exact words of the contract. The contract out of itself said we're going to hire somebody.
You have your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Your Honors. Marty Pujalar, counsel for Port Jobs. Counsel's correct. The issue before the Court is whether Judge Spearman properly dismissed Ms. Argo's claims, her single claim, under the Washington Law Against Discrimination, RCW 4960.030, because of the finding, number one, that Ms. Argo was not an independent contractor. and number two was not a third-party beneficiary. It's undisputed, despite initial opposition by Ms. Argo, that Ms. Argo is an employee of Neighborhood House. That's now admitted in the record. So we got to the issue of whether Ms. Argo is an independent contractor. Within the record is volumes of documents that were submitted in support of the position that she is an independent contractor. Not only is that document in front of both the trial court and the Court of Appeals, but plaintiff argued in the trial court level in response to Port Job's first motion for summary judgment that Ms. Argo was indeed not an independent contractor. They went as far as to even analyze the factors of WAC 162.16.230 to reach the conclusion that Ms. Argo was not an independent contractor. So plaintiff herself argued she was not an independent contractor at one point in this case. Went back before the trial court again on that issue of whether she was an independent contractor, and Judge Spearman properly found that she was not an independent contractor and dismissed the claim. Further support of the independent contractor argument is plaintiff's own declaration. It's part of the record. It is her second declaration in opposition to motion for summary judgment. In that declaration, she clearly states, I was under the control of supervisors as to the manner, method, and means of how I did my perform my tasks. I was under the control of what my work schedule was, who I had to get requests for leave of absences, whether it be sick leave, vacation leave. The only logical conclusion and conclusion supported by the facts and the law in this case is that Judge Spearman was correct in finding that Ms. Argo was not an independent contractor withstanding under the Washington law of discrimination. So the Washington law of discrimination, who has standing to bring a claim under RCW 4960.030? Two people, an employee or an independent contractor. Judge Spearman found properly, and it's undisputed, that Ms. Argo was an employee of Neighborhood House. Neighborhood House was her employee. Neighborhood House hired her. Neighborhood House compensated her. Neighborhood House terminated her employment. I think a very important critical fact here, Your Honors, is that there was a one-year contract that we're dealing with here. We had 6 years of contracts, but they were continuous one-year contracts. And we're dealing with a contract period for the January 1, 2011 to December 31, 2011 timeframe. That was the contract between Neighborhood House and Port Jobs, during which time Neighborhood House was going to outstation its employee, Ms. Argo, to perform services.
So are you saying that even if she was an intended beneficiary, the intention was limited to the one-year period?
The contract itself, yes, Your Honor, there are a series of one-year contracts, and it specifically says in the contract the termination is for 1 year. The termination of the contract is for 1 year, and they were successive one-year contracts. And when this contract ended, this contract term ended, the contract terminated by its own words in December 31, 2011. Because of some funding issues, Neighborhood House and Port Jobs ceased their relationship, a long-standing successful relationship. They ceased their relationship. Because of the cessation of that relationship, Ms. Argo stopped providing services at the Port Jobs office. I think this is a key important fact in all of this that is not brought up by the appellant in this case. Ms. Argo continued to work for Neighborhood House after the cessation of the contract between Port Jobs and Neighborhood House. She continued on with Neighborhood House under Neighborhood House's employment at the same rate of pay, at the same benefits. And then for some reason that we don't know, I guess only Ms. Argo knows, Neighborhood House laid her off.
That was like 5 weeks later, right?
Yeah, it was 5 weeks later, Your Honor. Correct.
So they kept her on for a month after the money ran out. Are you contending that's somehow significant?
I'm contending it's significant to show that she is a Neighborhood House employee and is continuing to work with Neighborhood House.
Well, let's assume that she is a Neighborhood House employee, but she still wants to claim that she's a third-party beneficiary. Okay, that seems to be what's teed up.
Correct, Your Honor.
And counsel in briefing urges the court to look to federal law. federal law couldn't be more explicit. The U.S. Supreme Court, it says, we're not going to answer this question. We're not going to say it is, and we're not going to say it isn't. And it, very seldom do you get a paragraph where it's so definitive in its desire to not answer a question. So what's the test for whether someone's a third-party beneficiary, and was she a third-party beneficiary of any of these one-year contracts?
Correct, Your Honor. First, I'd just like to say the standard's abuse of discretion, and it's in the briefing. Judge Spearman denied the motion for reconsideration on the third-party beneficiary argument. The first time it was ever brought up in the case was on a motion for reconsideration. It wasn't pled.
Okay, but aside from whether it was raised properly, and aside in the abuse of discretion standard would go to those timing factors. It would be an abuse of discretion to improperly apply the law or to apply the wrong legal standard. So, again, what standard should she have applied, and what's missing?
Yes, Your Honor, the case law provides creation of a third-party beneficiary contract requires that the parties to the contract. In this case, the parties of the contract are Neighborhood House and Port Jobs. Ms. Argo is not a party of the contract. Intend that the promisor, in this case Port Jobs, assume a direct obligation to the intended beneficiary at the time they enter the contract. That's in the papers. That's Burke versus Thomas. And then turning to Vikenstad, it says intention as disclosed by terms of the contract governs. So that's where I think this is a unique case and where this case is different. And that this case is different from any case, federal case or otherwise, is that there clearly is an intent by the contracting parties, in this case, Neighborhood House and Port Jobs, not to create a third-party beneficiary status for Ms. Argo. And I refer to the contract agreement for professional services agreement starting at clerk's papers 315, section X of the contract that says legal relations. And it says the relationship of contractor, who is Neighborhood House, to Port Jobs shall be that of an independent contractor, and here's the important part, and the contractor, its officers, employees, subcontractors, and agents shall not be considered employees, agents, or legal representatives of Port Jobs for any purpose. Now, when Judge Spearman...
Is being a third-party beneficiary being any of those things?
Your Honor, I would submit that it does not, because there is no...
Well, so why does that matter then? I mean, a third-party beneficiary wouldn't make you an agent
right.
of anybody. It just makes you a beneficiary.
In order to create a third-party beneficiary, there needs to be an intent on both of the contracting parties. Here we have zero evidence of any intent by one of the contracting parties, Neighborhood House. Zero evidence. And then we have the contract supporting the intent. And this is what Judge Spearman, the trial court, attached.
Well, what counsel's intimating, though, is that you've got a contract for certain work to be performed.
Correct.
Everybody knows that requires some human to perform the work.
Correct.
There's going to be money tendered from one contracting party to the other, and then some of that money is going to be spent on compensating somebody for the labors that they go to satisfy the contract requirements. So why isn't that latter person a third-party beneficiary? Isn't that what it all comes down to?
Your Honor, respectfully, I submit it comes down to whether there's an intent on the parties to create a third-party beneficiary, to put promises or create. I respectfully submit that you require an intent on both parties to create.
Well, didn't both parties intend that somebody would do this work?
Your Honor.
I mean, they intended that the work would be done, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And there was an amount of money paid, and presumably that amount of money was paid because somebody was going to have to do the work.
Correct.
Okay. So didn't the two parties intend that that person would benefit from the contract? And that's the question that Mr. Beauregard raises.
Correct. And I understand Mr. Beauregard's question, and that is the crux of this case. And again, I revert back to there needs to be an intent by both contracting parties that there be a specific intent. And that, Your Honor, is not present in this case, which is supported by the contract, and which is one of the reasons Judge Spearman did not abuse her discretion in denying the untimely position on reconsideration. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you. As to the, I know this court hasn't asked a bunch of questions about the procedural component of this case, but in case the court is inclined to look at the procedural history, I'd just like to note that Judge Spearman ruled on substantively on the third-party beneficiary argument. She actually read it.
Well, she ruled on both. She said you were procedurally barred, and then she went ahead and answered the question.
She did, and she actually wrote an opinion
about
it.
You agree that as far as the procedural bar, the standard would be abuse of discretion? As to whether or not she was going to consider something that you had not raised before the hearing on the summary judgment motion, the court has discretion, subject to an abuse of discretion standard, to consider something else on reconsideration.
I agree with that statement of law. However, in analyzing this issue coming into this argument, the point I was trying to make and the point I was trying to note is that Judge Spearman did do the analysis. So I'd submit in a context wherein, for example,
you know, belt and suspenders. She said this isn't properly raised, and then she said, nevertheless, there's nothing to it.
And then she ruled on it.
And then she ruled. Yeah, well, she ruled by saying nothing to it. So,
So
you got two rulings, right? Not just one.
I submit that my best argument is, and one, a case like this should be decided on the merits. Two, the judge did rule on the issue. And three, if you look to some of the law embodied in an employment discrimination case, it talks about the justice that's supposed to flow from these cases and the broad nature in which they're supposed to be interpreted. So,
doesn't the position you're taking make virtually every employee of an independent contractor a third-party beneficiary?
If the evidence supports it, yes. That's right.
So Judge Applewick and I wander into McDonald's, and we look at the dollar menu and find something bad for us. Mm-hmm. And then we enter into a contract with McDonald's to get two bad-for-us chicken sandwiches that are each, because they're each only a buck. And we hand McDonald's, and we hand the employee two $1 bills plus tax, and they give us the food that's so bad for us. We've entered into a contract with McDonald's. Is that cashier a third-party beneficiary of my contract with McDonald's? Because I had to pay, because Applewick never will.
It's kind of a tongue twister of a question, and I don't know.
Well, I mean, is the cashier a third-party beneficiary of my contract with the cashier's employer?
No, not in that circumstance.
So what's different here?
Here's the difference, Your Honor, is this. Substantively, the truth is Ms. Argo worked for Port Jobs on these facts. And I'd submit that the court should consider Chipotle or someplace healthier than McDonald's.
Okay.
But that's not the issue before the court. On these facts, Ms. Argo substantively really worked for Port Jobs. And, you know, most people first hear the phrase the parade of horribles in law school, and sometimes it's appropriate to make that kind of argument. Sometimes it's not. Here, I think it is. Now, this is an incredibly important issue because if this court were to rule against Ms. Argo, what this court's doing is it's creating a carve-out wherein if somebody wants to protect themselves against discrimination claims, just write up a contract and make sure that it applies in the way that they're asking this contract to apply. In other words, Ms. Argo has absolutely no remedy for employment discrimination, for whatever form of discrimination you want to put on
it. Well, she would if her employer replaced her with a person that set up a factual claim for discrimination. But her employer didn't do that. The person with whom her employer contracted, as I understand, ran out of grant funds. The contract expired, and now when subsequently there are funds available to restart a program, someone else is in that position.
And it's meant that the issue about the funds, we would rebut at trial as pretext. What happened is that Ms. Argo was actually replaced by her perception and in reality by someone prior to the during this interim time frame. She was replaced.
So you think the expiration of the contract is of no consequence?
I think it's evidence that the defense will use to argue to the contrary, but if you get into the nuances of the record, it's quite clear that Ms. Argo was replaced and replaced irrespective of the contract.
Well, in terms of somebody being a third-party beneficiary, if you're a third-party beneficiary of the contract and the contract expires, do you have standing to compel the contracting parties to enter into a new contract so you can continue to benefit as a third-party beneficiary?
I'd say absolutely not. However, I'd say if there was discriminatory motive in the circumstances under which the contract was negotiated, then there might be an issue, but I'd say no.
So where's the line between my McDonald's cashier and Ms. Argo? Where in terms of determining who is a third-party beneficiary of a contract between two other people?
I struggle with the McDonald's analogy because if I understand the court, you're saying...
Well, I pick McDonald's because it's an employee. This person's clearly an employee of the McDonald's franchise.
Right.
And we've now, I think I've heard you concede that she was not an employee of Poor Child's, but an employee of the other organization whose name I'm forgetting.
Right.
Okay. So because she's, I'm just trying to come up with, somebody is an employee of one of the contracting parties. When does that person become a third-party beneficiary? Because every employee is going to benefit from contracts with their employer.
I submit that the question is answered, and it's in page 11 of our brief, citing straight from the Lonsdale opinion. If the terms of the contract necessarily require the promisor to confer a benefit upon a third person, and there's also language in some of this case law that says direct benefits to the third person. So we're not talking about in a very abstract principle. We're talking about direct benefit, and here Ms. Argo was most certainly the direct beneficiary, not some tangential employee. So I understand the court's question better now, but I think it's the directness at issue, and that would be the rule.
For there to be directness, doesn't there have to be an identity to the direct benefit that's in the contract at the outset, not one where you fill in the blank later?
I'd submit in a context like this one, wherein the contract said, we're going to hire one person, it's very clear that one person would be the beneficiary. If there was 15 people, that would be inconceivable under these facts. Here the contract expressly contemplated one person, so at least on these facts there's limitations, and I think that the court could write a rule that would not give everybody in the world standing to bring a claim.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes that argument. The next one is